Hey guys, I'm here to tell you about another excellent mid-roll podcast called How Did This Get Made? It's honestly one of my favorite podcasts. I listen to it all the time. You've probably heard about it. I probably don't need to tell you much about it other than that it stars Paul Scheer, June Diane Raphael, and Jason Mantzoukas, and they celebrate movies that are so bad they're incredible. And more often than not, they end up talking about favorite movies of mine. Like this past week, they just talked about Virtuosity, legitimate favorite film of mine. They've talked about Congo, also a favorite film of mine. I feel personally attacked by this podcast more often than not. But yeah, in their latest episode, I mentioned that they talked about one of my favorite films, Virtuosity. They did it with, it's a live episode with guests Sarah Silverman and Taron Killam. It's an excellent episode. It's a whole lot of fun. You guys should go check it out. You don't want to miss this one. So listen and subscribe to How Did This Get Made on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Hey everyone, there's a new podcast from our friends over at the Stitcher Network. It's a serious, in-depth look at the story of Heaven's Gate. You might remember Heaven's Gate from the footage all over TV, the uniforms, purple shrouds, and black Nikes, and people who believe they'd be taken to heaven in a UFO. Well, there's so much more to the story than that. The new podcast, Heaven's Gate, talks to people who lost loved ones and people who still believe in the cult to understand the cult's mysteries. Whatever you think you know, prepare to be surprised. It's hosted by Glenn Washington, and if you've heard his other show, Snap Judgment, you know this will be good. Hear it for yourself. Subscribe to Heaven's Gate, the podcast, for free wherever you listen, like Stitcher or Apple Podcasts. Plus, hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with Stitcher Premium. So here's the thing. Welcome to the Crack Movie Club, the show where we try to make you an expert on your favorite films. I'm Tom Ryman. Abe is out this week. In his place, I have my guest host, David Bell.
Hello.
And we're the self-appointed crack movie experts. We're here to point out some things you may or may not have known about your favorite classics and drop some observations that might ruin the movie for you, or maybe not if you're adult enough to handle it. It's totally up to you. For the next hour or so, we're going to be talking about John Carpenter's 1982 film, The Thing. Along with us is our guest, David Huntsberger, who is a very funny comedian and host of The Junk Show and the Space Cave podcast.
Hello, gentlemen.
Before we begin, David, first let us know, when was the first time you watched The Thing?
So I rewatched it yesterday, but I don't even know if I rewatched it, because I wasn't 100% sure as I was watching it that I had seen it all the way through.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, I remember certain scenes, and like, but I wasn't absolutely certain of the plot and stuff like that. So I had either seen it like when I was real young, mm-hmm. you know, in like 89 or something like that, or maybe I haven't seen it, like it was just on TV or something and I caught it from time to time, but I definitely wasn't one of those people that was like a huge devotee of John Carpenter stuff. I mean, I've seen the Snake Plissken movies and that sort of thing, and going back to The Thing, I was like, this seems like a movie I should have watched because it has a lot of like the tropes that a lot of those type of movies seem to be birthed from. The weirdest one I thought was that, or maybe this is reserved for the second half of the podcast, but like it became such like a cliche thing of, oh, there's a black guy. He'll die early. Like they even made jokes about that in movies, go like, I'm going to die early, guys. Like, and then you'd be like, I hope that guy doesn't die early, but he's right. We've seen so many movies where this happens. So watching the movie, I was like, oh no. This dude's gonna die early, and they, not to give anything away, but they didn't. And
you're right. Yeah, there are two black characters, Knowles and Childs. Childs does not die, and Knowles, I think, is the very last one to die.
So yeah, watching that, I was like, I think I would have remembered this.
Well, if you saw it on TV, they had the network broadcast version, which was heavily re-edited.
The TV version of this is wildly different.
Also, this just seems one of those movies that everybody remembers, but not quite. They don't quite remember the ending. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people get together with their friends, have a few drinks, watch The Thing, and then it all kind of
once
fades to black.
Hour
near
the two
end.
Comes around. Maybe it's just one of those because it was one of the ubiquitous VHSs that you'd see in the video store.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I know I've seen the cover of this movie a thousand times.
Oh, yeah. I wonder how many conversations I've had with people where they're like, well, you know, like in The Thing, and I'm like, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. So before we begin, David, if you would please humor us with a brief one or two sentence synopsis of what happens in The Thing.
Okay, some researchers at an outpost in Antarctica are greeted by a mysterious dog and trouble ensues. I don't know. They then must have to confront a mysterious evil that takes various shapes, and they're unable to pinpoint exactly what it is. And they must escape. I just keep going and going.
Oh, and then that part. Yeah, that is that's a pretty accurate sum up. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Feel free to join us in the segment we like to call Terrible Loglines.
Kurt Russell refuses to let an alien invasion kill his buzz.
Alcohol is heavily involved in this movie.
The first alcohol thing could also be tied into one of these, is Kurt Russell loses at computer chess and everything goes downhill from there.
That's so funny. That's actually one of the ones I had written down. No, it's fine. A man loses a chess game and it really sets the tone for his entire weekend. Like, I had written that down. A crew of restless men are sent to Antarctica with booze and flamethrowers.
Alcohol and flamethrower experiment goes predictably awry.
Clumsy alien pilot just can't get along with new campmates.
Nice. A shape-shifting alien discovers that there are only, like, two different kinds of parkas, much to its advantage.
And that one weird cowboy hat that Kurt Russell
His hat! His hat's incredible!
Give me my Yosemite Sam hat. I'm gonna go look for some stuff.
Helicopter fights dog and loses.
They do.
They lose hard.
Those are two very inept men.
Really, really terrible way to set the stage for how good that movie is.
I know.
And then beyond that, they land the helicopter. A group of men come out to see a foreigner, just someone foreign to their camp, pointing a gun, and they're all like, what's going on, man?
Yeah, what's he doing?
He shoots one in the leg, and no one does anything. They just go, well, are you just going to keep doing that? No one makes any effort to run away or to tackle him.
As we established, they are all shithouse drunk right now.
I was going to say, it must be business as usual. That's what they're seeing.
Because, like, the first thing that happens is the doctor comes running out with one of, like, several bottles of JB that are heavily featured in this film. And the guy just takes it and starts drinking it while he's been shot in the leg, which you shouldn't do because alcohol is a blood thinner.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, it is a bizarre introduction to the film to have,
it's
like,
so weird.
That, and then also the fact that he blows his own helicopter up in, like, the most Looney Tunes way possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he throws his arm back too far, and the grenade just goes flying. And he's like, shit!
Then the other guy goes to get it.
Yeah!
I'll just keep digging through the snow here.
I think it was designed so that we see these people at the end of their own, basically, the thing adventure, where they're just fucking out of their minds.
Right,
at that
that's true.
All right, well, now that you know the plot of the film, let's dive into the making of the movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending. At this point in John Carpenter's career, I'm not sure how much of a John Carpenter fan you are, David, he had had a couple of big successes off of very small budgets. Like, obviously, Halloween was a huge, at the time, it was like the most successful independent film of all time. And then right after that, he had The Fog and Escape from New York, which all did increasingly more business, and also he kept getting increasingly more budget. So leading into The Thing in 1982, it was his first movie made with a major studio, Universal.
Okay.
And he had like a serious budget for this movie, obviously, because all of the effects in the movie are really complicated.
Mm-hmm. And they're cool. They still look
great.
Oh, yeah. They were he described it as the studio was sort of courting him at this point, right?
Like, yeah, he
made
like
a lot of successes for them, and they really wanted him to make a picture.
Yeah, it was so
them.
Weird to be watching a lot of contemporary behind the scenes stuff for this movie where it's stuff they made around the time it was coming out, and they're talking about hot young talent, John Carpenter. He's the next big thing in horror. And it's like, I can only conceive of John Carpenter as the 70-year-old man that he is right now. So yeah, this was like right when his career was set to like blow up, mm-hmm. was this movie. And it was a big, high profile movie because it's a remake of an older movie by Howard Hawks, The Thing from Another World.
It was based off of the short novel Who Goes There?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that at the end because I was curious. Like, did he write this story? And then I saw it had been a book. And then, that makes sense.
This adaptation was based less off of the original movie and more off the book itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was something I thought was interesting, which we'll probably come back around and talk about. But a lot of the reviews, this movie was not liked when it came out. A lot of the reviews are pretty savage. If you go back and read them, you're like, damn. But one of them was calling out, I think it was the New York Times review, was like, this movie has no reason to exist because, like, sure, the original spawned important ideas that were used in, like, Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Alien, but it's, like, redundant to make this movie again, which I thought was interesting because the idea of, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers or Alien, where it's, like, this hidden threat that's, like, sneaking among you and it's, like, mimicking other people, they explicitly don't do that in the Howard Hawks version. Mm-hmm. It's just this Frankenstein plant monster.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, John Carpenter's version actually is much more like the original story in that it's an alien that shapeshifts into people and is trying to hide as a person. So yeah, that person was full of shit.
The scene where the dog kind of walks in and you just see a shadow, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Like, so you, for the rest of the movie, you don't really know. And I feel like if they were making that movie now, they would have been a little bit more, it would reveal a little bit more. I feel like almost our patience has diminished or something like that.
I agree with that. And you can point to the ending of this film, the endless discussion about the ending of this film, and kind of relate it to also like the endless discussion about the end of Inception. Mm-hmm. People, I feel like general audiences don't have patience for things that are ambiguous. Mm-hmm. Like they want to know they want to know more often than not, like specifically, what does that mean? What is this? Like they want to be shown exactly what's happening.
And that's a shame when it's the point, you know,
right, it's the point of the movie.
Movie is the paranoia between all these men.
Well, there's a Twilight Zone episode about thinking some people in your neighborhood are aliens, and then the neighborhood just goes insane. They just lose their minds about it. And that sentiment there, that humans, when driven by fear, resort to their worst. They are quick to panic, quick to judge, quick to be violent, quick to... And I thought this movie just did such a good job. It really holds up. Like... Jurassic World, which is a strange like thing to bring in, but it to me kind of represents that, like you got to go after that not only just broad audience, but like an international audience. Dinosaur chases woman in high heels, man with leather jacket, hero. So anyone in any language can kind of just watch that and like, ooh, this is getting dicey. You don't even have to understand any dialogue.
That's the point, yeah, too, for it to play internationally, so you don't.
Yeah, you could just watch it and be like, these effects are really good. Whereas in this one, it has that Jaws element where you don't fully see the monster. And even when you do, you see little snippets. And then mostly you're just seeing that thing of like, is that the bad guy?
Yeah.
Is that the thing? You know, it's great.
It's so good in that way. The original script of this movie was actually being developed by Toby Hooper and his partner, Kim Henkel, those were the two guys that made Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm. And Toby Hooper had worked on the script for a while, but the deal didn't work out, or things happened.
Universal brought this to John Carpenter, which I always thought was weird because when you watch Halloween, the movie they're watching on the TV in that movie is the thing from the other. Yeah. And so I figured like he had just been like dying to make this film, but they brought it to him.
Yeah. That is a weird coincidence.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. The script that they eventually went with in this movie is written by a guy named Bill Lancaster, who is the son of Burt Lancaster, and also wrote The Bad News Bears.
Hey, I like this guy.
Two wildly different films, but yeah.
It should be noted that the idea of the creature didn't come so much from that script. It came from the special effects supervisor, I think, on this, Rob Bottin. He's the guy who's responsible for most of the creature effects you see on screen. And he was the one who came up with the idea that it could look like anything it wanted at any point. And he brought John Carpenter a bunch of sketches of what he had in mind, including stuff like the how the chest bursting open would look and the dogs and all that.
Yeah.
And that was, at the time, a lot of people... we're really nervous about that look because from an effects point of view, that's a really difficult task. But John Carpenter really wanted to avoid the concept of a guy in a costume, in a rubber costume. So he wanted these creatures to look really complicated and weird and not like something that you could just say, oh, that's just some dude.
Right. Not like anything that anybody had seen.
Right.
Not look like the monster from the original thing. Not look like the alien from Alien, which is scary, but you can still, oh, that's a guy in a costume.
What year... we're pretty close, Alien and this, right?
Alien was 79.
Because I was going to say, like, this has this H.R. Giger kind of look. Just a certain little bit of, like, maybe
that
it's the...
visceral, a lot of orifices.
Yeah, yeah,
a lot
exactly.
of orifices
yeah.
on the thing. And Rob Bottin had come from... he was a protege of Rick Baker, I think. And he had done The Howling. And there's a couple of interesting transformation sequences in The Howling. Nothing as good as... Rick Baker did in American Werewolf in London. But yeah, he was like a real young guy, and apparently he clashed a lot with some other of the effects people on, like some of the more, I forget the guy's name, but he's a guy that would do like the snow effects and like some of the more just like, not practical in that sense, but like fire and like snow and like the less like creature effect stuff. Mm-hmm. Apparently he really butted heads and got a lot of resentment because he was so young, and also because making this movie... because all the creatures are so complicated, he was very, very behind. They weren't able to actually shoot any of the stuff with the creatures until like the end of filming, and they had to kind of bring the cameras to where Rob Bottin was making this stuff. They brought in Stan Winston, who people might be familiar with because he did the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. He did the Terminator effects, stuff like that. They brought him in to do the dog that's in the kennel, I believe, right?
Yeah, one puppet, the dog puppet.
And that was just because Bottin was so far behind, and they were like, we got to get this rolling. So they had Stan Winston come in and do this dog monster.
Right. Bottin was apparently sleeping at the studio 7 days a week.
Yeah, he was killing there. Himself. Like, it's not, and, yeah, I'm not, yeah, man, not trying to shit on the guy.
Oh, no, yeah. At the end of production, he immediately had to go to the hospital. But, yeah, just listening to his interviews, he's clearly kind of, I think I would use the term reckless in the way he does the effects, and we should get into that later. But, like, I could see how working with him on set could be kind of a pain in the ass. At one point, he blew up the set on one effect, and we can get to that a little later when we talk about the effects in more detail.
You want to talk about casting?
Kurt Russell.
Yeah. Third John Carpenter film with Kurt Russell.
But at this point, you said Escape from New York was before this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then what was the first one they did together?
They did a TV movie called Elvis.
Ooh,
where Kurt Russell played Elvis. And that, I think, was in 79. And then Escape was 81. So they went, like, literally right from Escape to this.
Yeah.
Like, I think they mentioned on the commentary, Kurt Russell was like, well, I didn't have to do anything. My hair was already that long for Escape, so it was just growing the beard.
He originally didn't want, or he wasn't, he didn't think Kurt Russell for the role originally, and he actually, like, him and Kurt were brainstorming who to play MacReady, and eventually John Carpenter was just like, do you want it? So, like, in the behind the scenes, Kurt Russell's just like, yeah, and I went back and actually read the script this time, and yeah, I went with it. And apparently MacReady was not supposed to be, like, the main character throughout.
Right, it was supposed to...
He was just, like, the last man standing, but once they realized that, like, everybody sort of looked the same and was just, like, it was hard to distinguish the characters, they knew they needed, like, one person to stand out.
Yeah, it feels like some of that's still left over a little bit, because there is, like, a midpoint when, like, the older army guy, like, says, oh, I can't be in charge anymore, and that's when, like, Kurt Russell as MacReady officially, like, comes in and it's like, okay, I'm running things now. So it felt like there was still a little bit of that, like, well, let's have this character be kind of like in the background, sort of like Ripley in Alien,
right,
where it's not clear she's the main character at all for, like, the first
but
part
I
of that
think
movie.
Because you open on him playing chess and because he's Kurt Russell, you're like, yeah, all right, Kurt.
So yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, I think there were elements of that idea still there, but then obviously once they had Kurt Russell and it was just like, yeah, he's clearly the he's clearly the main character.
But when at the end, when they're doing the credits, and it is kind of like a play, they say everyone as so and so, this guy as Doctor da da da.
Yeah,
effects and the, but each guy, like, as they got to their name, I was like, unless you were just like a disciple of this movie and know it inside and out, I think most people would be like, name three of the characters outside of maybe like Gnarls. And yeah, you're like, who is that guy?
Yeah, you can't.
There's so many that they just hang out.
Yeah, yeah, nobody. Nobody's calling each other by name. Yeah, it's the very, yeah, it's yeah, I'm with you on that one. The only reason I know the characters' names is because this is one of my favorite movies. But, like, yeah, like, outside of MacReady and Blair,
yeah,
mm-hmm,
and maybe Childs, but yeah, outside of that, it's like, I don't know who any of the, I mean, you recognize them on sight, but it's like you don't hear their names.
Yeah,
well, it's funny you should mention plays, because a good amount of this cast came from theater. Keith David, who, you know, we know from movies now, at the time he went to Juilliard, and this was his first movie, and he had gone to school with a few of these people, and they handled it very much like theater. They got really into their characters, which John Carpenter found hilarious.
Is this Childs?
That's, yeah, Keith David
is Childs.
So, he's the president on Rick and Morty now.
Yes.
He does,
and
a lot of voice work.
Him as the dad in Something About Mary.
Yes,
which is,
yeah,
like,
he is.
Oh, man.
Are you yelling at me in my own house? Man, what a fantastic career.
But it's so weird to come from theater to, like, even the thing, like, because it does feel like there's a solemnness to it.
And it's,
like,
one location.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, they go to the Norwegian base, but it's pretty much all one location. You could probably do, like, a pretty neat stage version of this.
Oh, I think,
man,
so,
yeah,
yeah.
The effects would be really fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that would be rad. I really want to see that now.
Yeah, why has no one done that? Or maybe they have and it just didn't become
Hamilton.
Didn't
take off. Yeah. Man, let's make a thing musical.
Yeah.
let's make this shit happen.
Keith David as Childs. who most notably he had broken his hand right before they started filming. So if you watch the movie, he's hiding his hand a lot.
Like in the scene where Wilford Brimley is going insane and bringing up the radio room, like Childs comes running in and ducks behind Kurt Russell, but he does it in such a way that's like very conspicuously obscuring his hand because they had it wrapped in a glove and then painted it like his skin tone. So like if you just caught it briefly, you wouldn't be able to tell it was this gigantic cast on his hand.
How weird also that Wilford Brimley is already old here. And then I feel like most of us know him as like a very famous guy with that big ass mustache.
Yeah.
So when you see it, you're like, he was a young man once with no wait, he's not young.
He's not even that. Yeah. He
was never young.
He looks like he's been old. Wilford Brimley has been old for like 35 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's so weird.
Because 2 years after this, 2 or 3 years after this, he made Cocoon. Where the point is he's an old person again fucking around with aliens.
He was also, he was such a curmudgeon on the set from the stories and from the interviews. Like, he's totally not into the thing.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite things of watching all the in research, gearing up for this episode of the podcast, watching all the behind-the-scenes stuff. It's clear he doesn't give a ghost of a shit about this movie.
You can pick it up when he goes, let me come back in. I want to come back in. He's just like mailing it in.
I'm all right now.
I'm all right.
Such a good
scene. I won't do anything to anyone.
No, I won't hurt anyone. But he's like so, you're right, he's just coasting.
Yeah, there's no emotion. And it fits the like beautifully. I'm sure John Carpenter is like, say it however the hell you want because you can't ruin it. If this guy is like lost mentally and he's just saying it like with no affect, fine. If he's totally passionate, fine. So it does fit, but it does ring a little weirdly. Like, what's going on with this guy?
It's jarring. And he's also delivering it sitting beneath a noose that he's made that nobody ever
addressed.
They never address the fact that he's sitting beneath the noose.
The single best shot of that movie.
Yeah.
My so good.
Favorite Wilford Brimley behind the scenes was one of the actors was really pumped about his role and talking about how he took a class in biology and maybe that could apply. And Wilford Brimley replied, "What for? This movie is about rubber and steam," which is like sums up the movie perfectly.
And it also sums up Wilford Brimley perfectly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like he just couldn't give a shit about this movie, which is wonderful.
I picture, you know, that scene where he like puts his hand into the guy's face.
Yeah.
And just doing that, like as they did the third or fourth take, like, what is my life?
And yeah, we mentioned that the voice of the computer is the only lady in the film, and that's Adrienne Barbeau, who was
Escape from New York.
Yeah, she was still married to Carpenter at the time.
Right.
But yeah.
That's neat.
Only lady.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's very, especially nowadays, any movie, anything you watch, like my girlfriend's a big fan of the Bechdel test, mm-hmm. which is like, you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, yeah. So the moment like this movie started, you feel it like, well, they're not going to introduce a woman midway through. You're like, there are no ladies. But sometimes like movies, I don't know, if it would feel inauthentic if they crammed someone in. I think you could remake this movie now and have like both doctors be women.
They kind of did that, yeah.
And the Thing prequel that came out in 2011, there are two female characters. The lead character is Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
What John Carpenter said about this, because he actually notes the all-male cast in the behind the scenes, and he sort of said that.
It was even unusual for the time.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He was like, yeah, there were, you know, women researchers, obviously, at this time. And I think part of it, because he says, like, I thought at the time that an all-male cast would be good. He even seems like he might have done this differently today, the way he talks about it. But I think it probably played into the fact that I think this movie was designed in a way that he wanted everybody to kind of look the same. And that was part of the paranoia.
Right, yeah, there's a couple of things, like, you know, the terrible logline joke about there only being two types of parkas. It's because there's a couple of scenes in the movie where you see somebody running from far away and you can't tell who it is, mm-hmm. because everybody has a very similar coat. And the scene that David pointed out where the dog walks in the room and you only see the person's shadow, you can't tell who that is.
Mm-hmm.
Could be anybody's.
Yeah.
And what was the guy's name? They find his glasses.
Fuchs.
So do you guys have, like, I mean, I want to talk about the end, too. You said, like, that's the thing people discuss a lot. But I think mm-hmm. that's a point of, like, there's relevance, I suppose, in, like, keeping the story fairly, like, off target at that point, or, you know, creating a little mystery. Like, maybe he faked his death and he's the guy, or whatever that is. But I thought that was, that was it. They didn't come back to it in any way.
That's a strange one. And apparently there was a couple of times in the movie where certain characters' deaths were rewritten. That was one of them. They were originally going to find that character staked to a wall with a shovel.
Right. Mm. John Carpenter realized that it didn't seem like that was something the creature would do, because yeah. the creature consumes you. It wouldn't just stab you against a wall and walk away.
Yeah, I can see value in both, though, because he still leaves in this character gets murdered.
Gets murdered and yeah. burned.
Yeah.
And so, like, the creature... Why would the creature do that?
Yeah,
it doesn't so the only serve other, him in any way.
The only other... And it's you're right. It's so weird that they don't come back to it, because the only other explanation is that one of the other people killed him thinking he was the thing and then burned his body. And then was like, oh, shit, he wasn't a monster. I better never say anything about this.
Yeah, yeah. And but that makes that the most sense.
Yeah.
But someone could have... Like, they could have just panned out of him like, I'm sorry, Jake. Or, you know, just like...
it's Wilford Brimley. Thought he was a monster.
I didn't care for his glasses.
He tried to tell me something about raising horses and eating oatmeal, and I just wasn't having it. I knew only an alien would try to tell me that stuff. Didn't smell like an alien when he burned. Anyway.
A few more notes on the cast real quick is Richard, what's Richard Macer?
Yeah, Macer.
Yeah, he played Clark. He turned down E.T. to be in this movie. And he was auditioning for Poltergeist and didn't get that, and Spielberg offered him another role, which was eventually E.T., and he decided to do The Thing. And both movies pummeled The Thing in the box office immediately after this.
Yeah, but so, as an actor, especially a theater guy, listening to Elliot and his high-pitched scream all day on E.T. would get exhausting.
Yes.
And it's not like adults have real cool parts in E.T.
No, I'm trying to think of who he would... Would he have been the Peter Coyote role, I assume?
I don't know, yeah. This was definitely a better role.
Because the dad's not there. Yeah. But that was... I think the reasoning was is that, you know, Spielberg, he does this a lot. We mentioned this when we did Spielberg Month a little while ago, where it's like he'll try out an actor for one thing, like that actor, but not... like them for that part and be like, I'm going to put you in the next movie. Mm-hmm. And same thing, like I think the little kid from Jurassic Park auditioned for Hook and he was like, well, you don't work here, but I'm going to put you in Jurassic Park. So he wanted to do it with this guy and be like, well, I can put you in E.T., but he hadn't cast E.T. yet.
Oh.
And this master was like, well, I've put the offer to do The Thing on hold already. I can't make them wait any longer. So he took the sure thing opposed to I might get a role in this movie. Whenever.
I hope he's not living his life with regret about that or something.
I don't know.
No, in the interviews, he seemed to...
He seemed cool with it.
Yeah, he seemed to think this was the better choice ultimately.
He later showed up in the TV version of It.
Oh, man.
Yeah. He plays Stan. He plays adult Stan. Slits his wrists.
He totally does.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Moving on to the final cast member I want to mention is the dog. That is Jed. This was his first role. He was half wolf, and he went on to play White Fang. So
yes.
That's
I recognize
that's
that
his only other role.
White Fang was in the 90s, too. This dog was old.
Yeah.
Old dog.
Yeah, this
dog hung in there.
He was described on set of being, like, very spooky, too, which it fit for the role, because that dog is pretty creepy in a lot of
There's
scenes.
Some legit good acting from that dog.
Yeah.
Again, in the scene that David pointed out, where it walks down the hallway and goes in the room, like, that dog knew, like, its timing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the dog knew where its marks were.
Well, it very well.
A lot of those scenes took hours. The part where he's walking with the dog, I think Clark?
Richard Macer is walking with the dog.
Yeah, with the dog. That took a few hours to get. Because there was the whole method of having the dog walk with him without calling him or signaling to him. And so there was a lot of, because it was kind of a finicky dog. And so they had to be very like patient and quiet on set with it. But it paid off. And going to that shot where he walks in on the room and there's the shadow... We should probably talk about who that shadow actually is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that shadow is none of the cast. It is a man named Dick Warlock, who we've mentioned in the Escape from New York podcast. He is Kurt Russell's stunt double with the best name ever.
So they just wanted it to be as ambiguous as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
because you think about, like, so Clark, I thought of another role that Clark played as well. He was Teen Wolf's dad.
He is. You're right.
Yeah.
He is Teen Wolf's dad.
And he really maybe grew to like the sort of paranormal sort of, it's my genre. But his silhouette would stand out, I think. Wilford Brimley would, I think, stand out enough. But when I saw the shadow the first time, I thought, that's Clark. Mm-hmm. I thought, like, he's the only one that's had contact with the dog. The dog's new in town. I'm like, hey, man.
Yeah.
And he does, like, as far as dog acting, kind of like come to the door and there's almost this like, is it cool if I? Okay. Like, he just has this recognition of like, I'm going to come on. It doesn't look sinister of like, yes, I've gotten you alone.
You're right. Oh, man. And then, of course, they do the bit later when they lock Wilford Brimley up. He's like, watch Clark.
Yeah, yeah.
Watch him. So they, like, really, really
that was a good Brimley. Watch Clark.
This guy can do voices. Should we move on to the
crew members? Yeah, we should move on. Dean Cundey's the director of photography. He also worked on Halloween and Escape from New York with John Carpenter.
Right, and you would also know him from shooting. He was the cinematographer for Jurassic Park, Back to the Future, and Apollo 13.
So, shit.
Yeah, he has quite a career.
He's got some hits.
He does. It's a good batting average for that guy.
Yeah. We mentioned Rob Bottin. I wanna point out that he went on to do movies like Seven. The most recent thing you would recognize is the from Game of Thrones when King Joffrey dies. Spoilers. He did the makeup on King Joffrey.
Oh, when Joffrey
gets his weird
when he's
veins
choking
and
to
stuff.
Death. Yeah,
that was a gnarly shot.
Yeah, they brought him on just for that. So I thought that was neat.
It's a good use of Bottin.
And you need a certain level. I mean, you have to reward the audience because they hate a child. Then you kill that child. You're like, I want to see this goddamn kid suffer.
Yeah.
And they really captured that well. Like, ooh, that looks real painful.
It's got to be grotesque.
Another person I want to point out, it's a small role, but the stuntman, when they set Palmer on fire during the blood testing scene.
Yeah.
The guy who was on fire, that's Anthony Caesar. He went on, he played the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters for some of the scenes. And he was a double for Freddy Krueger. So he is a pretty neat horror.
Wasn't that particular stunt pretty crazy? Because he's in costume with a monster prosthesis on and he's on fire.
Yeah.
And he's inside. Yeah. Like it's an interior set.
When you watch those behind the scenes, like, here's how we do fire, you know, and
they just
like,
set things on fire.
Well, no, I mean, the stunt guy is like, heats up so much. And so maybe if it was really cold there, it gave him an added element, but just fire on your person and like your lack of oxygen. I feel like I saw it once where they're like, if you can get 9 steps, that's pretty good. And so I like, when I watch those scenes now, I'm always like, how far are they going? And that dude walks a long way, like walks out the hallway.
Takes
and then
a stroll.
Yeah. It's a pretty impressive fire scene.
Yeah.
There's a couple other fire moments in the movie, like Childs and MacReady both wield the flamethrowers. It's just those actors shooting flamethrowers.
Mm-hmm.
And in the scene where they burn all the Thing corpses, you know, they dump a bunch of branded Chevron tanks of gasoline on them. You can see the little Chevron.
Did Chevron pay for that?
I don't know, but there's like there's one shot where it's like really, really clear. It's the Chevron logo.
I think Knowles does the first one in the dog cage, doesn't he?
No, it's Childs.
That is?
It is Keith David.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Because he's yelling at him and he's just staring like.
Yeah.
He's like, light it up.
Yeah. I go back and forth on that scene. Because I'd be like, yeah, I'd probably be pretty dumbstruck. But then another part of me would be like, I might also just immediately, oh, no, got to burn that.
way too early. Yeah.
Part of me would want to see how it played out.
Yeah.
Like, Let's see where this is going.
Let's see where this monster's going. But yeah, the scene where they fill up a pit with the Thing corpses and gasoline and Kurt Russell just ignites it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see the force of when the fire catches, it splashes gas out of the hole. And it's just, and that's gasoline.
Wow.
And it's just with their lead actors sitting there and like the entire cast around him just shooting a flamethrower into a pool of gasoline.
Wow.
Oh, great man. Film.
Such an
different time back then. Insurance rates were nothing.
Yeah, he does. John Carpenter does say something to that effect when they bring the first Thing corpse in, the one that they recovered from the Norwegian base. You know, it's got like the two
faces.
Yeah,
that's maybe the most impressive as far as like a cast. You have the face that dips down the mouth then into another kind of half face.
I think those are all sculptures.
Was Rob Bottin.
Yeah, those were the Bottin ones. And they're just sculptures, but they're covered in like this goo to make it like wet and seem gross. And they put it in front of the cast, you know, and covered it with this type of smoke so it would look like it was smoking. And apparently it's like a particularly pungent type of smoke that they don't use anymore. And like when Carpenter is talking about it in the behind the scenes stuff, he's like so dismissive. He's like, yeah, you can't do this anymore. People are sensitive now. But like back then we could make that smoke stink.
It was a very like smelly set from what I can tell. Cause the goo that you mentioned was usually a combination of mayonnaise, creamed corn, strawberry jam, and KY jelly.
Oh, and
so,
the
delicious.
The binding chemical in Twinkies.
Oh, okay.
That's like what they spray the dogs with, like in the kennel when the thing is like spraying the shit. It's like whatever kind of, I guess, gelatin it is. It's
safe for dogs.
Yeah, it's like harmless, but the dog's clearly not having it.
No.
The dog's like, I don't like this.
Which is funny that, like, a dog can't... I mean, granted, like, from the actual actor dog's point of view looking, it's just seeing humans spraying that thing at him. Mm-hmm. But through the lens, we are seeing a dog react exactly like it's being hosed off by someone. So there's no different... Like, to us, a dog reacts to getting hosed off in the exact same way it would react to an alien shooting some sort of substance at him. Hey, cut it out! Stop that!
We can tell no difference. Let's talk a little bit about the effects, I think, are probably the most interesting part.
Yeah, let's go through all the effects. each moment, because there's the one we just mentioned, the dog monster. That is the Stan Winston puppet that you talked about. That the way they designed that, I thought was kind of silly. It was they took a picture of Stan Winston just holding his hand in the air, and then they just designed it around that picture. Because I think it was kind of a rush job, and it's basically just a hand puppet. It's Big Bird. Like, it's a guy just in there with his hand through the dog's neck.
And then one arm?
Yeah, and just one arm. So that's all that is. And then this was a cool detail, is that dog puppet evolves into that bigger creature that kind of goes on the ceiling.
Yeah, with, like, the crab legs and everything.
Yeah, and it has that, like, flower opening. Yeah. And one detail I never noticed is that when you look into that mouth, it's a bunch of dog tongues and teeth. Which is disgusting.
That's really gross.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Like, what's it doing at that? Like, what's the alien doing? It's like, this is a dog, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No.
I think it accidentally got, like, several dogs, so it's like, oh, shit, I don't know how to... Then there was the chest monster, the defibrillator scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah, when he opens and eats the doctor's arms.
Yeah.
It's funny how they can all change a little bit. Like, because you start to get used to, like, oh, they're all going to do that. They're going to do the dog thing. And then when he puts his arms through, and like, oh, they can also snap off your arms.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then the head grows legs and eye stalks. It's like, I feel like that must have been a direction at every point in the film. Be like, this monster should be totally different from the one we just saw.
Yeah, every single time.
It's just fucking
what's the
crazy.
Line when they look over and the head has grown spider legs? And they're like, bullshit.
He just says, you gotta be kidding me.
So you gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yeah, that was
that's
it.
What he says.
Apparently, I forget who suggested this, John Carpenter didn't get that shot originally. They wrapped...
Oh, yeah. That was a thing with Richard Masser.
Yeah.
Like, they had shot that sequence, but that line's heard off screen and it's showing the puppet walk away. And apparently Masser told Carpenter, he was like, no, you want to get that guy saying that line because it's hilarious.
He was right.
And he was right. It's a fucking great line.
So
that,
the way...
That in the end when Kurt Russell says, yeah, fuck you too. Yeah. He blows it up.
So the way they shot that whole sequence, the first part, the chest opening up, that was the actor, Charles Hallahan, and he had to stay in a rig for a whole day with just this fake chest that apparently, according to him, perfectly copied his chest hair. They took a picture of his chest, and he was very impressed
kind of
how accurate that was. And if they messed it up, it would be 2 hours to reset. And on the first take... Because the stomach has to rip open, so it's really hard
to
reset.
Reseal it and everything.
So the first take, the stomach ripped open, and it just, like Monty Python style, gushed fluids. And I believe, according to Rob Bottin, he said that, like, it did that, and he was just like, oh, crap. And then you just heard John Carpenter yell out, thank you, Mr. Bottin. They had to move on, or they had to do it all again. The actor hated that.
It seems awful,
For when the doctor reaches his arms in, obviously the arms for the close-up are fake. That's wax bones and then gelatin, jello.
Those bones are so gnarly.
Yeah.
Like, you see him just, like, ugh.
It's a really
awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good effect. And they just had hydraulics that would just shut on the fake arms and snap them off. And then for the reverse shot of the doctor reacting, they actually got a double amputee and put the actor's face as a mask on him for him screaming.
Oh,
and
wow.
So that's how they did that. I thought that was pretty neat.
I always thought, I could always peg something was weird about his face, but I didn't. I always thought it was like some effect to just like exaggerate his features.
Oh, I was zeroed in on the arms. So that was smart of them.
That's the guy.
Oh, yeah. And then the neck rips off. They had puppeteers in the table. And they had a push rod pushing the head so they would rip the neck. And that neck was filled with melted plastic and bubble gum. And it was all just...
This is just like the nastiest movie.
Yeah.
But so fun for those adults to have to put... How are we going to do this? Just being like
little
kids.
We're just going
to
cram it with lunch.
And it created
some cream corn and mayonnaise in here.
It created like a really acrid smell in the room. And right before they were going to... do this shot, someone pointed out that for continuity, they needed fire kind of in the back, in the bottom of the shot. So they have this thing called a fire bar, which is just like a bar with holes in it that flames come out.
Yeah, sure. You see them in like theme park rides.
Right. Yeah. And while they're setting this all up, the room is just filling with fumes. And they call action, light the bar, and it just all explodes. And they had to reset and do the entire thing the next day. So they blew up the set at least once. And moving on to the head spider, that was also a really cool rig. That was basically a radio-controlled car with the head on it.
And you can kind of tell
On
one shot, because it's just the legs are kind of moving like ineffectual. It's still a good effect.
Well, the way they did the legs was neat is they had six wheels, you know, three on either side, and each leg was attached to the wheel. So as the wheel rolled, the legs would go up and down.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it was a neat rig. And, I mean, the final Blair monster, that was mostly stop motion.
Yeah, there's a big puppet for, like, the close-up. But, like, when it bursts to the floor and grabs the dynamite plunger, that's obviously stop motion.
Stop motion and miniatures. That was done by Randall Kirk and Susan Turner, who also does the...
Yeah, she did the spaceship in the beginning.
She did the ship at the beginning as well. Which it ended up, they sent her a mock-up, and her spaceship ended up being the exact same size as the mock-up, and it has a bunch of little LED lights on it. It was a really cool little thing. And we should talk about then the main titles, which I find to be the most interesting effect. That was Peter Curran. I'm terrible with names.
Pete, if you're listening, let us know.
He did the title sequence to The Howling as well. And the way he did that is he took a fish tank, and he had it upside down, and he drew
the title, you know, the thing title, and then covered the back in a black plastic trash bag, lit it from below so the light would shine up through, and then just set it on fire. Mm-hmm. So the letters burn away, and then the light shining up through.
So that was a totally practical effect.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Like and it looks great. That's like so cool. That's so basic how they would do that.
People don't talk about him, but Albert Whitlock did the matte paintings on this, and he did the birds, Catch-22, The Sting, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Earthquake, Airport 77, and Spaceballs. He is a legend, and that's most of the part where they go and find the spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just matte paintings shot mostly on the Universal backlot. So
they do a good job of kind of masking it, because it does seem like they cut it off right at their ankles, but you can see a little bit of snow kicked in there. But the way it matches to the background, you're like, yeah, I'll buy it. Like, it doesn't look too delineated. You're like, well, this is absurd.
Yeah, they do a good job of blending the different depths of field where the different paintings come in. Yeah, it looks really good. So this movie, when it came out, it was released the same day as Blade Runner and 2 weeks after E.T.
Did not do well.
It was destroyed in the box office. Part of it was because Universal had another movie they were working on called Cat People, which was nowhere near being done. So kind of at the last minute, they swapped the release date. Like, Cat People was supposed to come out at this point. But like, no, the thing will come out because the thing's ready to go. So they had like no marketing. They contacted legendary poster artist Drew Struzan to draw the poster, which is the snowman and with the light coming out of his face. He had to do that in an evening.
Wow.
Like, they called him on the phone. I was like, can you do a poster for tomorrow? And he's like, what is it? Like, well, it's a remake of The Thing. We have no pictures or anything to send you. He's like, all right, I'll come up with something. So that's what he sent them. He did that painting. Cool. Overnight, and the studio came by the next morning to pick it up. But like, that's how like last minute the release of this movie was.
Right. And just if people don't know who he is, Drew Struzan did, you've basically every poster from the 90s, pretty much.
Back to the Future. The documentary about him is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. But he did Back to the Future, the Indiana Jones movies, Star Wars. Blade Runner. He did all the big ones
and hand painted all of them.
Yeah. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
I wish they would do that more often instead of the bad Photoshops that come out now.
Yeah.
The movie did terribly. Reviews were savage. Carpenter has gone on record saying that he's had a few failures, but this is the one that like stings him the most, because he feels like if this had worked, because as we mentioned at the top of the show, it was right when his career was about to blow up, his career would have gone, he feels, very differently had this movie succeeded.
The one place where I would fault him is the fade outs. Like, they don't quite conclude scenes necessarily.
Yeah.
And they just fade it out.
It fades. Yeah. I can see that. I seem to remember that was more the editor's decision, but I can't remember exactly. But yeah, I sort of agree. I also feel like there's a certain kind of mood to the film, the slower pace kind of, I don't want to say malaise, but there's like this kind of half asleep sort of quality to it where it's like they've been isolated for so long, they're all fucking tanked. And it's like, you know, it's just white everywhere. So you're just kind of like this, you lose track of how much time is passing and things like that. So I could make an argument that it might be intentional in that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, yeah, fade outs. The one in particular that I think is strange is when they come outside to McCready and like, let's take her up. And he looks up and it fades out on his face. And then it fades back into him walking back up to the helicopter and they haven't left yet. Right. So it's like, that was a weird decision. You just didn't have anything else to cut to right there.
There are moments like where they are experiencing it and you're kind of guessing and it's tense. And I thought the dialogue and the way they handled it was very like, trusting and sort of, I hate when people use the word masterful, but you know, like what it feels like, this person knows exactly what they are doing, like mm-hmm. they're taking you through. But then there are other things where, like the dog scene at the very beginning, the guy getting shot in the leg stuff, you're like, well, this is kind of cartoonish, you know?
The dog scene also takes a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like that dog is running through the snow for a very long time.
Yeah. They could show one shot and get right to him losing at chess.
So we talked about how the movie was made. Now let's get into some observations. We're going to start it off with a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
This is like symbolism and stuff you might not have noticed in the film. And Dave had an interesting one about eye lighting that
This wasn't mine. This was the cinematographer in a recent interview, in a podcast, I believe. He pointed out the blood testing scene, which is an amazing scene. Mm-hmm. If you look at each actor, they all have eye lights, which is, it's hard to describe. It's like the glimmer in the eyes that they do specifically in the lighting. All of them have that except for Palmer, who is, of course, possessed by the creature.
The thing. Yeah, the stoner guy.
So if you go through the movie, apparently you can notice this throughout. But I'm not sure about that. I know that in that scene specifically, he shot it like that.
That's interesting. So they didn't have a light source on their eyes?
Yeah, it's like you see it in movies all the time. They have a specific light. I wish I could remember what it's called. It's just the reflection of one of the lights in their eyes that... You see in a lot of movies. The one that I always remember is Alien Resurrection. Every character has this big circular light in their eyes. But apparently that's how he shot it. So that Palmer was the only one with like these sort of lifeless eyes in that shot. So that was a cool little bit of visual symbolism.
That is definitely something that I never noticed.
Yeah, I definitely didn't. Who would catch that?
I think when you're a cinematographer and your job, your entire job is how a movie looks, like you have so much time to think of this stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I think nerds catch it.
Big old nerds.
Yeah.
There's also something they touch upon briefly in some behind the scenes stuff, and it was pretty much intentional, but this movie came out in the early 80s, which is of course when AIDS was first like beginning to be discovered and understood. And so the fact that they came out with this big contagion movie, and at the time they didn't know sort of what AIDS or HIV was or how to test for it or anything like that. Some people attached that meaning to this film, even though it was, according to Carpenter, was not intentional. They just happened to have an alien who is essentially in essence a contagion rather than an actual being.
When they're cutting the thumbs and he just wipes it on his pants.
Yeah.
Like, do it.
Well, yeah. Also, like Blair, like Wilford Brimley, when he's like poking the alien dog with his pencil and he sticks the razor
he's like
in his
holding
mouth.
It up to his...
Dude, like.
No, they don't.
That's
give
a
fuck.
Monster. Yeah. Wilford Brimley did not give a
and
shit.
Why cut the thumb? I mean, they do a gash in the thumb. They could have just done a little pinprick for some blood.
Really, let's them like, have it.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's going to be make it difficult for you to do things for the rest of this movie. Like, I can't hold these. I can't hold the flamethrower anymore.
I love that they're in a situation where they need to do a scientific blood test, and it comes down to the idea of the pilot at the station. Because Kurt Russell's the pilot, right?
Yeah, they're like biologists and like actual scientists. And he's like, we're going to heat up this wire and poke the blood.
And he's completely right.
And he's 1,000% correct. Yeah.
And yet not prepared to be right.
No. Right.
He's just holding it. It really
like,
scares
even,
him.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's a good scene.
All that paranoia that was good in the behind the scenes. They point out that sort of the original and Body Snatchers was that Red Menace fear and stuff. And this, they wanted to focus more on that, the paranoia itself being silly. Like, it's not about being, it's not about being afraid of like communism or,
right.
It's about being afraid of being afraid of that stuff. It's about the paranoia.
Yeah, and being afraid of your neighbors.
Right.
David mentioned something at the top of the podcast about a old Twilight Zone episode where it's an entire neighborhood becomes convinced that someone among them is an alien.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, at the end of the episode, it pulls out and the aliens are watching and being like, well, if,
yeah.
These people are crazy.
Is this happening everywhere? It's happening everywhere.
Yeah. So, yeah, rather than it being like a direct Red Menace sort of thing, it sort of fits into what Carpenter's movies were, which is anti-authority, anti-establishment, and sort of like the idea of humanity's institutions breaking down. And this is sort of like more of a suburban fear, if that makes sense. Like that Twilight Zone episode, I really absolutely agree with that connection. And it's just... because it's not about, like, the thing is not a creature that's invading with some ideology or an established culture. It's mm-hmm. just trying to get by disguised as something else. And they have no real reason at a base level to be like, this thing needs to be destroyed and we need to be afraid of it, because it's just trying to hide.
Yeah.
It just picked a pretty terrible hiding spot.
Exactly, yeah.
But the guy in the camp that they find that's all burned down, where he has, like, aggressively sliced his own throat
yeah.
and then frozen to death. And that, like, he was seeing the same things. He was seeing something turn into something, like, devour his friend, which, yes, is frightening, but also seems beatable. Like, the thing, while we're watching the movie, you're like, oh, okay, it is, yeah. You can yeah. solve this. You can sniff this out. And they did such a bad job.
Yeah, they screw everything
they're
up.
They're constantly yeah. breaking off into teams, and like, they could have just yeah. huddled up. Like, all right, let's just stay here.
All right, nobody leave. Yeah. We're all going to watch everybody. Yeah, they do keep doing that, where like one or two people will go off and they'll come back and be like, hey, what's up? Or there was a monster. It's like, oh, great. Well, now we don't know what to do. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that guy just, the guy in the Norwegian base just locked himself in there. And just like, well, I can't trust any of you. And then just sat in there and was like, killed himself.
Yeah.
So the original is sort of a Red Menace story, allegory for the Cold War and communist insurgents. And this obviously still has those elements, but the alien's more of a virus rather than representing any sort of developed or distinct culture. So the threat isn't an invading culture. It's a malignant entity that isolates you from your friends and coworkers and makes you not able to trust anyone or for anyone to trust you. So we're still in the Cold War in 1982. This could also be, it's also kind of like post-Watergate Reagan commentary on the idea of American exceptionalism. And that's... earning everything you've got and then protecting it from everybody else. So it winds up kind of turning everyone against each other. You know, this is a time when rising crime rates, or like the illusion of rising crime rates, were starting to make people be suspicious of their neighbors. It's like when people started to lock their doors, you know, serial killers were a thing now. So it's, this movie, I feel like, is more of a suburban horror story than a global one, even though the ultimate threat is global.
That's funny you mentioned like hiding, that like that alien pilot's superior would have said, and just keep in mind, if you crash, remember how we can do that thing with our cells? Just turn into them. Like, just blend in.
You'll be cool.
That goes into one of my theories, which, well, there's the question of, were they piloting that ship, or did they take over whatever was piloting
yeah,
that ship?
Yeah, I always thought that they weren't the, because we see the ship crash in the beginning. So I'm like, oh, I took that as the thing infected that spaceship and it sort of took over the crew, and that's why they're crashing.
But then when Wilford Brimley is sort of building his own.
Yeah, he's like building
which is right. so crazy.
That's another
he
bathroom.
Dug way down under.
Yeah.
Where'd the snow go? No one saw just like tons of snow coming out of that cabin.
I built a spaceship out of like garbage and corrugated metal in 2 days.
Right, so the aliens are advanced.
Or yeah, is that just, weird. Does he just have... There's so much like about the thing that's like you can just sit and think about forever, because it's like, does it have the memories of every single thing it's copied?
Right.
Because it does take their memories and their personality.
Mm-hmm.
So is he drawing on,
so you
like,
couldn't do that thing of like, all right, you must be the thing, otherwise you would know, what knee of mine did I skin 2 weeks ago? And the thing of like, I have it.
Yeah,
I have that.
Yeah. I got that.
Which that leads to the question, what happens if they took over the entire base? And, like, couldn't build a spaceship? Would they just sit around and, like, just be these people?
Yeah, if they, the thing
and
won,
like,
yeah,
I'll
just
get
be
drunk
them.
And play more chess.
Would they like forget? It's like when they yeah. like two of them break off together, and the one starts like thinging out, and the other one's just like, dude, I'm also, I'm
yeah,
also
yeah.
A thing.
The whole planet is. We're just us like, still. Oh, shit, you're just a different planet. Like, our blood like does this thing when you know. Touch it with hot stuff. Otherwise, we're exactly the same.
Same problems, yeah.
Still got to go to work.
Yeah, because it. I feel like it can't be the pilot, right? Because it doesn't... It's the thing's more of a virus. Like, it's not an alien that could really have, like, a culture or, like...
Well, that's what I thought, yeah.
I mean, maybe if there are... I mean, if you were sending that out, these tendrils, these, like, sentinel sort of things, you would want them to do that. Go recruit us. It's like in Game of Thrones, like, the Army of the Dead. Like, go, go make a bunch more of us, bring them back here.
Right.
So maybe that's what happens. Like, they stay in that form until they get on a ship, get brought back, and then go, all right, guys, you can turn into yourselves now. Like,
I like my theory. My theory is that the ship that crashes looks really, really close to the saucer section of the Star Trek Enterprise from The Next Generation. And there's an episode of Star Trek where there's a shape-shifting alien that takes the form of a dog. So my vote is that it's a crossover time travel situation
somehow
where the Enterprise was taken over by
thousands of years in the past.
And crashed into the past, and that's where we got the thing.
No.
And I refuse to have anybody correct me on that.
Well, like, my one last thought, I'm not going to say last because I could, you can think about this forever. Like, well, do they know their things when they become the thing?
Right, yeah.
Or do they only thing out because that's, like, a defense mechanism they can't control? Like, when he pokes the blood with the wire, like, it can't control that? Because
none of them have any tells to give away, like,
no.
Now, fellas, let's just say. And they do it a couple times where, like, Clark is kind of being like, oh, he's saying thing stuff. Like, that's what a thing would say. Like, right. guys, what if we just kind of, let's not attack him?
But it turns out he's just an asshole. Like, he's not a monster at all. He's just a fucking dick. And then, like, Palmer, who's, like, the chillest dude and also is, like, gets, like, you know, combative with other people. He's like, I don't want to fly with him, or being like, I don't trust that guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't, like, plant seeds of specific doubt or suspicion to anyone. He's the one that turns out to have been the monster.
Yeah.
But it's like, he's not doing any monster things. He's not like, no. You know what we should do is,
we each should one, all,
each one
pair
of you
off.
Should, yeah, each one of you should sit in a room alone with me.
Well, yeah, that's it. It really does seem like it's something they don't have control over. Like, it's a part of their body.
Yeah.
Because every single time one of them is exposed, they don't seem to be happy about turning into this
doesn't
creature.
Look comfortable.
Yeah, it looks like some sort of fungus or virus, something that would happen in nature
yeah.
when it's exploding
or,
out of
and
them.
I'm going to assume, like, the crab legs and all the weird shit is, like, earlier aliens that they copied.
Yeah.
Or it's
yeah.
just like, well, here's some of that.
It's just trying to adapt to the situation
yeah.
in front of it.
And if that's the case, the thing's plan is just baffling. Because when the dog gets to the base, the Norwegian guys are dead. Nobody's the wiser. They just put the dog in the kennel. It's like, dude, you've won.
Mm-hmm.
Just wait. Just wait it out. They'll take you back.
You got
to
it. Civilization. Yeah, you're right
like,
where
just
you
continue
be.
To be the dog.
It must not have a plan then, right? It must.
Well, even if it comes
see
off.
See other warm bodies in the room and it's just like, I want to be all this. Like, I'm going to take all
it's
this.
It's reactive.
Yeah.
And maybe it is like, it's not the queen bee. It's like the little sort of drone bees. Like, you go out there, you sort of pollinate, come back. There's no free will or thought about it. You know, just when you get there, you will reactively, like, start trying to turn other dogs and make them into things. But I wish when the things turned, they had just, like, little tells that if people could have caught it. They were like, did I seem like an inch taller to you? Or just little stuff where the other guys would have been like, wait a second. You're like, are my teeth whiter than normal? Wait a second.
The actors debated that, actually, when they were rehearsing. And a lot of them concluded, like, they were the ones that would turn. A few of them concluded, I'm just going to act the same no matter what, consistently. Mm-hmm. And some of them did, apparently, act a little differently. But I kind of like that. I don't know. I kind of like the idea that there's really nothing, because that makes it creepier to me.
Yeah.
Is that there's no tells whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Which you would think just cells, even if they are totally different, you would still be like, oh, I need to have a nap. That was a lot.
I guess the last thing we can talk about is just the ending real quick.
So sure.
Remember you had wanted to come back and talk about the ending because that's a controversial part, I guess. Not really controversial, but it's a part that, like, a lot of fans, like, through the years will just continuously ask Carpenter and also the cast, like, so who was the thing at the end? And it just won't accept the ending for what it is.
Yeah.
Carpenter has said that he knows what the answer is. He's not telling, which I think is just his way of keeping it ambiguous, which
right,
is
he just
point.
Doesn't want to answer it, yeah.
No matter who's the thing, they're still drinking, which is consistent.
Yeah,
good.
They're both getting drunk. The they're aliens just like accepted it. Yeah.
We keep our eye on Kurt Russell pretty much the whole time.
A lot, yeah.
So we see him a lot. Either way, like, the idea is they're just going to freeze out. So if the thing out survives, say Kurt Russell is not the thing and he dies, he freezes. Theoretically, the thing could, like, head elsewhere, warm up, and wait to then get hauled away after. One of the two could do that. I just wish in that moment, Kurt Russell would have looked at him like, you play chess. And then they just end it out.
Start making little pieces out of snow.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have anything else to do. My personal interpretation of the ending is I've always felt that neither one of them is the thing.
Same here.
Interesting. I just felt like because we didn't see Childs for a while, it just seemed like that was the chess game that was happening there. And that was Kurt Russell's only move to make is like, if I can stay awake long enough and sort of outlive you, if you freeze to death or if we freeze to death at the same time, humanity will survive, or at least the thing will have died, even if he dies with it. That seemed to me like kind of the, here we go. We're entering into this final battle.
Yeah. There are enough parts earlier in the film, though, where MacReady could have become the thing.
But his blood, from the blood point on, we see a lot of him.
That's true.
Maybe it can harm its own blood, though, if it knows it's doing it. Yeah, that seems like a stretch.
I mean, we don't really know the rules. We just know what they have figured out, which is part of what makes it so scary, is that they have nothing to go by. So, yeah. We don't know. Maybe the whole blood thing was a big ruse. Like, maybe they can communicate telepathically, and he was just like, I want your blood. Because maybe they're all just one big entity anyway. We don't know.
That's true. We don't know what the hell these things are. Hive mind.
Yeah.
I also, from like a studio and filmmaking standpoint, all the things he's saying, like I know who it is or I don't want to tell, as it is there with the two of them, sets up pretty nicely for like a sequel, theoretically. Say they both survive, they get Brock back.
Yeah. That was Carpenter actually mentioned that he had an idea for a thing sequel that would start with those two characters getting picked up by a rescue team and then go from there. But he's like, but it's never going to get made.
Maybe it'll have a resurgence of some sort.
I don't know. I think the prequel that came out in 2011 sort of killed that.
They come to rescue them and they've just been there for like 30 years. Yeah. And that's why they're old.
I just keep coming back to, I feel like neither one of them's a thing for two reasons. One, I feel like thematically that's the best version of the ending because it's like their mistrust and paranoia is what's going to kill them, not the fact that one of them's literally a monster. And that just fits in perfectly with sort of like the bleak like worldview of John Carpenter movies. All of humanity's institutions will come crumbling down.
Yeah.
And then also I feel like if one of them was the monster, they wouldn't have that conversation.
Right,
like they would come together and be like, well, you're alone. I'm the monster. So,
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. He wouldn't wait it out.
No, I can overpower you. You don't have a weapon. I'm a fucking monster.
I think it's
tentacle time.
It's supposed to be ambiguous, and I feel like that's the point. But since it really could be anything, I'm going to vote for they are both the thing.
That would also be funny.
Yeah. And then they just like, they have a conversation, and finally they're like, wait, Are you?
No, because I think here's the thing I meant to bring up earlier that I was thinking throughout the movie. Like, it's very polite of the thing to not really have the most spring on you sort of attack method. It starts like, rah, rah, and then it's like going after you. So if they are sitting there and he has a flamethrower and they're just waiting out, like, as long as I don't fall asleep or freeze, if you freeze first, one or the other, I'll survive. The moment I nod off, then you can do your thing nonsense and get me. But I don't think it's that he's got him right where he wants him and can get him, because the moment say Childs is the guy and he starts like rah, 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 then he just fires him.
But Childs has the flamethrower, doesn't he?
I thought that
does Kurt Russell have it?
I thought Kurt Russell still had it, even in spite of all his like dynamiting and stuff. But yeah, I don't know if I fully remember. I should have paid more attention to that, because that would be the only explanation that like one of them could be the thing.
Right.
It's like, you, even if you were the thing, you're like, it's like going for your gun and knowing the other guy could shoot
right,
first.
Yeah, it's not the quickest attack. You'd be like, I need some time to prepare. for my tentacleness.
Yeah. It's just such a polite thing of like this vicious overtaking.
He's got to Hulk out first.
Give me a bit.
Oh, man. All right. Well, do you have any other points you wanted to cover?
Not really. I mean, there's still production stuff I would have loved to talk about. The sound design specifically is
beautifully done. Yeah. Like with horror movies having the like dun 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 dun, and they have this really screechy kind of over and over they do it, and it's done so well. It fits it really perfectly.
Yeah, and it was Ennio Morricone who did the music.
Sound effects was David Udall. When they test the blood and the thing comes out and goes, that's just him. That's just the sound designer making
nice.
That sound.
I love
that's
when pretty they awesome. Do that.
Yeah. Also the screeching sounds of the creature. That was him running his fingers on the soap scum in his shower, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And for the interior, for the wind, which plays a huge role in the film and you never realize it, but the sound of the wind is constant. That was actually shot in the desert in Texas, and he also recorded inside a dumpster, which to get the interior wind sounds, which found a very effective, and at least once he was caught in the dumpster by a stranger.
But don't you feel like, I watched E.T. maybe a year ago, we went to a thing at like the Hollywood mm-hmm. Bowl. It's mm-hmm. a fine movie, but yeah. I feel like I could watch The Thing more frequently. I think it like yes. is a more solid, kind of stands the test. The E.T.'s so great, especially when you're a kid.
Yeah.
But as an adult, you're like, shut up, Elliot. He's yeah. just yeah. so whiny like, the whole time.
The bleaker sort of nihilistic thing tends to start appealing to you more the older that you get. Like, no, this is
I love
is,
when stuff like that gets
now.
Like brought, you know, excavated, so to speak. That it didn't just because of the bad reviews and because of how poorly it was received just disappear. That people still went, no, this is worth, you know, keeping in our zeitgeist or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody mentions that. I forget who, but one of the members of the crew mentions that people don't remember how well a movie did in the theater, you know, 15 years after it comes out. All they have is the movie, and the movie speaks for itself. So the movie was good.
Yeah.
So
we all,
it's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, it's great.
It's really good.
I would love to see a crossover with E.T. I think that would be fun.
Oh, man. So I think we're done here. We want to talk about how you can talk to us. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Hit us up with your thoughts. Let us know what directors you'd like to see us do in the future. We've been Tom, Dave, and Dave. David, where can we find you online?
DavidHuntsberger.com, and I do a podcast called The Space Cave, where I have beers with scientists and chat about stuff that they know. And those are probably the two best ways. I do like social media stuff as well, but I'm not that wild about it. But you can find all that at DavidHuntsberger.com.
Cool, man. Well, great. We're so glad that you came out and did the show with us.
Thanks, guys.
Really
thanks for having me.
Thank
cool
you.
Show.
And make sure to check us out next week. We're going to be talking about Halloween. Nice. John Carpenter month will come to a close with Halloween.
It's perfect.
it's a good one. It's going to be exciting. So, yeah, that's it. That's all I got.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm W. Kamau Bell, and this week I'm guest hosting The Longest Shortest Time. I'm talking to my friend, Shannon Lee, a.k.a. Daughter of Bruce Lee.
Daughter of the Dragon.
I should just put that after my name.
Yeah, yeah. It should definitely be on your business card.
I should hand it with sound effects, too. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Bruce Lee died when Shannon was just 4 years old. She talks about how weird it is for the world to know so much about her father.
When I realized, like, oh, I know him intimately in a way that nobody knows him, I was like, neener, neener, neener.
She'll talk about her dad's philosophical side and what her own daughter is taking from the family legacy.
She always refers to that movie as the movie where Gung Gung fights that really hairy guy.
For those who are not aficionados of Way of the Dragon, that hairy guy is Chuck Norris.
That's right.
This week on The Longest Shortest Time.
What's up?
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.